And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I feel profoundly privileged to be speaking today on the morning show with Jamie Thompson, the author of an extraordinary book called Standoff: Race, Policing, and a Deadly Assault That Gripped a Nation. We are talking about her riveting account of a terrifying scene that played out in Dallas, Texas in July of 2016, when a troubled young man opened fire on police officers at a Black Lives Matter rally. What Jamie Thompson has done is tell this story with truly breathtaking detail. She has come to know so many of the significant participants in this incident. And as she describes what unfolded on that July night, she is also telling us about the backdrop which set so much of this in motion. And from these various participants, we hear all kinds of actually quite nuanced positions and opinions and perspectives on some of these truly vexing issues that are plaguing the United States right now. I was not expecting this book to be as powerful and thought-provoking as it was. Jamie Thompson covered this incident for the Washington Post, and a later account of that night that she did for the Dallas Morning News actually won her an Edward R. Murrow Award for Excellence in Writing. And having read this book now, I am not surprised at all that she was given such an award. She is an associate professor of journalism at the University of Dallas. Her book, again, is called Standoff: Race, Policing, and a Deadly Assault That Gripped a Nation, published by Henry Holt and Company. Jamie Thompson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you so very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I want to have you talk for a moment, first of all, about what it is like and what it was like for you as a journalist to cover this particular incident that occurred in Dallas on July 7th, 2016. I just want you to describe to us some of the challenges that are involved in covering something like this and writing about it, first of all, in its immediate aftermath and also from a longer perspective. I suspect that there are challenges that would be very obvious to most of us and other challenges that a lot of us would probably never even think about.
Sure, absolutely. I have spent many years of my career actually covering policing and police departments, doing sort of the daily ride-alongs and reading reports. And so I'm pretty familiar with how police departments and police officers think and work. And I think when this happened in Dallas, I think you, as you mentioned, you know, five officers were shot and killed in one night. And that is just sort of a shocking, startling number, in fact. So I got up and started reporting the story for the Washington Post pretty immediately and did things like followed the mayor around to some of the funerals and started talking to police officers. I think some of the difficulty in reporting is cops are not the easiest group of people to report on. A lot of them do not like journalists. They feel like we often get the story wrong and are biased and one-sided. So I think the main difficulty in this story was really spending the time to try to get to know the officers involved and having them eventually trust that I would take care with their story and tell it accurately. I think that was also an issue in terms of dealing with some of the other subjects. In the book, as you mentioned, it really tries to offer a variety of perspectives. One of those is a mother of four who went down to protest that night because she'd been very upset about the police shooting videos that she'd been watching. Another of the main characters is a Black trauma surgeon who has a lot of complicated feelings about race and has not often been very vocal about them. I think the difficulty mainly is just getting people to open up and share their stories and tell them in a really complete way. And that was probably the greatest challenge. But I think the most rewarding part of this is getting to know these amazing people that ended up being the main characters in the book.
Mm. One thing that is very interesting in your source notes towards the back of the book is you first of all talk about spending 3 years spending hundreds of hours interviewing the men and women who were on the scene that night in Dallas. And you say, many officers spoke to me without the knowledge or permission of the police department. Many felt as if they had been unfairly forbidden from talking about one of the most traumatic and important nights of their lives. It is a story they wanted told, not only for posterity, but for other officers who might find themselves facing similar threats. I wonder if you could maybe describe a bit about these interviews in particular, which in a sense, I suppose, were done kind of surreptitiously, sort of. I mean, not out in the open in the way that maybe officially sanctioned interviews might be permitted. Can you tell us more about how you went about conducting these kind of interviews and what those particular interviews really felt like?
Sure. So this event, I would say, is probably one of the most well-documented mass shootings that we've had. I mean, there's a lot of video. There were a lot of officers wearing body cameras. There were a lot of cameras on patrol cars. There's a lot of people with cell phones who took very startling images of the shooting as it was happening, of officers dying, of sort of exactly what happened. Other than a few cell phone videos that were pretty widely distributed by just normal people, the police department really did not release much of anything in terms of what actually happened that night. I think for several reasons. One, out of necessity at the beginning, because there's a pending grand jury investigation. And as is customary, whenever an officer or officers use some sort of deadly force, they have to go before a grand jury, and the grand jury decides whether they believe that use of force was justified. So I'd say in the immediate aftermath, they were sort of on lockdown with information so that process could rightly play itself out. But I think as that process went forward, the department did not really want to release much about the event. One, because it was controversial. They had armed a robot with C4 and essentially blown up the suspect, which they got a fair amount of heat for in some portions of the community. And they also really pretty bluntly told officers they didn't want them talking about it, which really frustrated a lot of officers because they think there's a great value. A lot of how they learn on the job is through hearing stories of other departments, hearing about critical incidents, what happened, what was done, what could have been done better or differently. And they really felt like it was a disservice to the profession in some ways to not go out and share these lessons that they had learned on that night. So essentially what the story became is we had this huge incident in Dallas that really nobody knew in great detail what had actually happened that night in the community college, how they had eventually brought the night to an end. So I started reaching out to officers individually, and it was a long process. It was essentially going officer to officer. I would find one who was willing to talk to me, and then they would introduce me to someone. And it really started as almost an oral history, just collecting the stories of the people who were there, lots of them. Toward the end of the reporting, the department did, to the credit of two other reporters who employed lawyers to help them force the release of some public records, they did release some documents, And I did also get access to some videos that were not released publicly and probably never will be, but they helped to really crystallize the detail of what actually occurred that night. So, yeah, it started mostly as an oral history and was supplemented along the way as I got to know people better with videos, audio, that sort of thing.
We're speaking with Jamie Thompson and talking about her book called Standoff, Race, Policing, and a Deadly Assault That Gripped a Nation. It chronicles in extraordinary fashion an incident which occurred in the heart of downtown Dallas on the evening of July 7th, 2016. One thing that we have not yet mentioned is the fact that what touched off this shooting, that as far as we can tell, what actually inspired this troubled young man to head down to Dallas heavily armed was a exceptionally disturbing video of police brutality that had just been made public. And it's in a sense shocking in and of itself that something as terrible as what you're about to describe to us is kind of lost in the blur, in the fog of so many similar incidents. I think at one point you say eventually the footage blurred into one long and never-ending movie that forced the country to stare into its brokenness. Tell our listeners about the incident that I'm talking about that was caught on video not long before this incident on July 7th.
Sure. So immediately before this happened, the video a video went out about the death of Philando Castile. And I think, as you'll remember, Philando and his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, were driving home from the grocery store, and they were pulled over for a broken taillight. And within seconds, Philando Castile was shot and killed inside of his Oldsmobile. He had a weapon. He was trying to inform the officer that he was licensed to carry. The officer perceived him as a threat and started shooting into the car. Philando's girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, began to broadcast the aftermath of that shooting on Facebook. And in my mind, the video she recorded, it's similar in some ways to the George Floyd incident. I think the video really touched people in an emotional way. You felt as if you were in the car with Diamond Reynolds as Philando took his last breath. You felt as if you'd watched this man die right before your eyes. And it really prompted people to get up and get out into the streets and start talking more and more about these incidents of police shooting black men. So that was really that happened the night before the shooting happened in Dallas.
So this protest in the heart of Dallas is, of course, in a larger way, a protest against a whole series of events, but this one in particular had really sparked off this and other protests around the country.
Exactly. And it along with the Philando Castile shooting, the night before that, Alton Sterling had been shot and killed in Baton Rouge. So you essentially had Alton Sterling shot and killed on Tuesday, Philando Castile shot and killed on Wednesday, and then on Thursday, people began gathering to march in cities across the country, including Dallas, and that is where this occurred.
Right. And as you chronicle in the book, 25-year-old Micah Johnson, this troubled man, saw this video and was so enraged that he headed down to this protest and opened fire on police officers and killed a number of them. I'm curious how it is possible for us to know this particular connection. Is there supposition involved or an educated guess?
Sure. So he actually told, he spent several hours talking that night to a SWAT crisis negotiator on a hallway. They're about 30 feet away from each other. This is after the gunman had shot and killed the police officers. And so we know that from the SWAT negotiator. He said the man told him. He had watched the video. He was very upset about that shooting and others. And this was his attempt at payback, essentially, that he thought there needed to be some bloodshed to further the revolution of really changing the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm.
So your book is, as I said, an incredible chronicle of what occurred on the night of July 7th, 2016. What is really interesting about the way you have laid this book out is that it is not just about that incident and a painstaking attentiveness to the details of exactly what happened and why, or to whatever extent we can know, but it's a highly personal book in which we come to know so many of the principal participants, including the negotiator that you just mentioned, Larry Gordon. You say at one point, the people in this story hold a variety of viewpoints. I wrote about them with the hope that readers might step into each of their shoes for a moment. And I think you've really achieved that. Why was that so important to you? Why did you feel like it was worth it to spend so much time in your book talking about these particular people, their respective backgrounds, their views on various issues, including, of course, policing and violence and so on? Why did you think it was important to describe this story in this fashion?
Well, that was my primary aim, and I'm thrilled to hear that you think I accomplished that somewhat. I think that, you know, when I was reporting the story, it really came together in pieces. The first part of it was really focused on the cops, and then I did a separate story about a trauma surgeon who was on call that night. He's a black doctor, one of the only ones on the trauma team at the city's public hospital. And as I kept reporting pieces of it, I really thought the story, those voices together as a whole, were a lot more powerful than any one piece. I think that's why I was interested enough in this incident to write a book on it. I think that on all sides of this debate are very thoughtful, compelling people with really important things to say. I think that a lot of times our conversations on the subject of race and policing try to reduce complexity. And I think that sometimes we really need to lean into that complexity and hear individual stories. I think we make just more progress when we know real people rather than theoretical ideas and concepts. So it became really important to me that you would sort of understand where the cops were coming from, but also understand why the mother of four sons had gone down town that night to make her voice heard, because she was worried about her children, and how the trauma surgeon is, you know, trying to navigate this largely white world of medicine, and how he balances, you know, talking and thinking about race. So I just found all of the people in this book to be incredibly insightful, and my hope is that you really get to know each of them, and they think very differently, and they come to these ideas with different experiences and histories, and I think put together they really give you a little more nuanced portrait of these issues of race and policing we're grappling with.
Absolutely. I could not agree more, and that is certainly true when it comes to the negotiator, Larry Gordon, a negotiator for the Dallas Police SWAT team. You spend a fair amount of time in the first chapter of the book talking about the work that Larry Gordon and his counterparts do as negotiators. And I found it absolutely fascinating. At one point, he is describing the uncertainty that is part of his work, or maybe the unpredictability is a maybe better way to say it. He never knew exactly who he needed to be until he got there, meaning whatever incident. hard or soft, commanding or gentle, deferential or aggressive, every call was a new riddle. Tell us more about what you learned from Larry Gordon about the complexity of the work that he did as a negotiator.
Sure. So Larry Gordon is, I would say, sort of the heart and soul of the book. He's the main character who sort of leads you through the night and everything that happens. And what's interesting about Larry is that he grew up in a poor black neighborhood. He has two older brothers who have been in and out of prison, got addicted to crack and really struggled with that addiction. Larry looks around his neighborhood as a kid, and he sees, you know, some of his heroes selling drugs, and he sees violence and shootings happening. And I think he grows up with the sense of the complexity of people. You know, you can have people do certain things and still be good people in a way. So he really approaches the world and his view of people in it with a lot of gray. He ends up carrying that into his profession. When he becomes a police officer, he decides he wants to be a crisis negotiator. And that is on the SWAT team itself. It is not a highly prized position. The SWAT team guys, you know, it is a testosterone-fueled world. They're having to handle a lot of dangerous equipment. They're having to run toward gunfights. They have to do a lot of things that are difficult to do. So there is a fair amount of testosterone in that world. The negotiators are kind of viewed as the softer guys who like to talk to people. And so Larry really enjoys his role. He really believes in the creeds of negotiating, which is everybody deserves to be heard. You need to approach policing with empathy and a lot of active listening. Treat people as human beings. And he really champions a lot of the fundamental tenets of the field of crisis negotiating, which also believes, you know, that everybody should go home safe. So you really get to sort of see inside his world and how that operates on a big city SWAT team.
Right, exactly. And he certainly has a way with words, and he says outcomes depended on whether he could find the right words. And in particular, I was really struck by something he said about the importance of someone who found themselves in such a desperate place with whom Larry Gordon would be negotiating, how important it was to convey sincere concern about them. He says, they could tell if you really cared about them. Gordon called it the music behind the words. In other words, you could say words about, you know, I care about you, ma'am or sir, I don't want something bad to happen to you. But if those words aren't believed, it doesn't matter. And there needs to be that sincerity or music behind the words themselves. What a fascinating concept.
I love that concept, too. And yeah, I think it's sort of, it's been an idea in the field, or it was early on, that somebody like a salesman might make the best police negotiator, somebody good at manipulating or cajoling or selling. And it was sort of Larry's experience on the job that really people can tell, especially those in crisis, when they're being conned and when they're being pandered to. And so he learned that lesson really early on, that you really have to show up as yourself and you have to really have some genuine concern for people, or you're really not going to do very well as a police negotiator, because people can really sort of see through you.
Absolutely. You have, you describe in terms of what it feels like for him to be heading to another incident. Another poor soul had let go of the rope, abandoning the notion that everything was okay or ever would be again. Gordon would take the wheel and head toward another unraveling. It's so interesting to think about somebody who willingly puts themselves into that position of dealing with people who in one way or another are unraveling. But what I really want to talk about is Larry Gordon's intriguing ideas about policing and racism and so on. And I don't remember if we've mentioned that he himself is black. And at one point, you say that in a certain way, Larry Gordon was too black to be blue, too blue to be black. Explain what is behind those really intriguing words.
Yeah, so I think that some of the most interesting people I've talked to in the past few years have been black police officers, and Larry Gordon is no exception because, you know, you're really straddling these two worlds. You have friends and neighbors and relatives who have repeated bad interactions with police officers. They get pulled over when they don't think they should have been. And so you're, as an officer, constantly hearing people say the things they don't like about the profession, and they're asking you, well, how can you possibly do this? This is a horrible, you know, way to earn a living, is to just harass black people. And Larry sort of absorbs all that and hears it and takes note of it, but he also sees the other side of it where he's out on the streets. He's done, you know, narcotics. He's done a lot of patrol duties. He's seen the violence and the destruction of drugs. And so he also has a view that law and order is very important. So he really is straddling these two worlds. I think cops, some white cops, are a little bit suspicious of him because he's not afraid to call out a bad shooting when he sees it. He thought Philando Castile in particular was a really bad shooting. So he always feels like he's not quite sure what they're thinking of him. And he also feels like he gets a lot of flack from friends and relatives about just his profession in general. So he's never quite fitting into either world.
Mm. I appreciate that you also, among other things, help us know one of the protesters who was in Dallas that night and someone who ultimately was shot, Shatamia Taylor, a mother of four. And one of the things I especially appreciate about what you share about her mindset that night when she decided to head down to this protest with her sons, her young sons, is that this was a rally to protest police brutality, not to protest police officers in general. It seems that for her, that distinction was a really important distinction to make. Tell us more about that and about her.
Sure. She is a really fascinating woman and amazing mother. And as you mentioned, went down that night because she wanted to make her voice heard. She was concerned about some of these shootings. But she has a very nuanced view, I think, that she, in that she can hold the idea that not all cops are bad and the idea that some things need to change and be reformed at the same time. And I think, you know, a lot of times in this debate, cops are typecast into these one-dimensional characters, and protesters are too. And I think Shatamia really represents more of the middle-of-the-road protester who really is very, like, reasonable and thoughtful about what she's seeking and trying to go out and make her voice heard to achieve some of that, but really does respect cops and thinks and has had some good experiences with law enforcement. And I think one of my favorite stories from the book is so she's with her sons in the street and the gunman begins firing. He is targeting police officers, but she ends up getting shot in the leg. She is desperately trying to protect her children. They are running and scattering. She ends up flinging herself on top of one of her sons behind a car, trying to keep him safe. And pretty quickly, they are surrounded by police officers. One of them is a white officer with a Texas drawl. You know, he's got a big dip in his mouth. He's out acting as an undercover just to keep an eye on things. And he starts sort of patting her and telling her, "We got you. You know, you're going to be okay." And she talks about how just the sound of his voice really carried her through the terror of the moment and made her feel like she was going to be okay. And I love, they've become great friends. They're in each other's phones as BFF, and they really, neither one of them can think of an occasion where they really would have met otherwise. You know, he's a white cop from Texas, and she's a mother of four, a black mom. And they've really developed this beautiful friendship. So, yeah, you get to sort of see that through her story in the book.
Right. And I appreciate so much that the observation is also made that these, in that moment when these officers crowd around her to try to protect she and her sons, these officers, the same ones the crowd had just been protesting, were encircling them. Just an amazing moment. We're speaking with Jamie Thompson, author of Standoff, Race, Policing, and a Deadly Assault That Gripped the Nation. It is her chronicle of the events that unfolded on the evening of July 7th, 2016, in downtown Dallas, Texas, when a number of police officers were shot and killed by a troubled young man enraged by a very recent incident of police brutality that was caught on video. And these dramatic and terrifying events unfolded in Dallas and gripped the whole nation watching. I appreciated some insights offered in your book about the place of the SWAT team within the Dallas Police Department. And, of course, although you are focusing specifically on officers in Dallas, I'm sure this is something that can be understood to be, at least to some extent, true of other SWAT teams in other police departments, but their interesting relationship with other police officers, with other facets of the police force, and one that is a relationship in some ways a bit antagonistic, and yet one in which general police officers look at the SWAT team officers with some envy. I mean, what an interesting, complicated relationship. Tell us more about this, about the function of SWAT teams on the typical police department, like in Dallas, and what that relationship often is.
Sure. So I'd say the majority of SWAT teams across the country are actually part-time teams, meaning that their officers have other daily jobs. And when there is a call they're needed for, they will then group together as a team and go out and attempt to handle it. Dallas is different, and it's a similar situation in Dallas as in other big cities, where they actually have a full-time SWAT team. So in Dallas at this time, there were about 40 men. There have been a few women in the team's history, but at this point it was all men. And it's a really competitive position to get. Lots of people try out. There's a pretty grueling tryout process. And only a couple make it, usually, out of the pool of dozens. So to get on the team, you have to be excellent at many different skills. You have to be good at shooting. You have to have good physical fitness. And what these officers really talk about, the thing you need most is to really have a tactical mind, which in their view is really being able to process adrenaline and stress, to be able to really think clearly and not overreact in moments of high intensity when your life is possibly on the line. So I think to function in this kind of team, it becomes sort of its own pressure cooker of tension. And a lot of the guys actually view it as, if you can sort of survive the SWAT team in general, you can be trusted when bullets start flying, because you are learning how to perform under stress where people are yelling at you and calling you names. And I think that, you know, when outsiders might read about their rituals or traditions or their language, it can be eyebrow-raising. But I think that when you think about it in context of what we are actually asking these officers to do, a lot of these officers will talk about, no matter how hard you train, it's incredibly hard to run into a gunfight because your whole body is telling you to flee. So when you think about this night in Dallas, I mean, you have a gunman who's been on the street with a high-powered rifle and has killed five officers on the street. And these officers are the ones that we are asking to run into the building and take care of this situation. And they're all running into that building with the thought that they may not come back out again. So it's an interesting balance of this sort of testosterone-fueled culture. But then again, recognizing that the jobs that we're asking them to perform, do they sort of require that to some extent to make it possible for them to function?
Along the way, as we hear from these various figures, you also tell us something about sort of the backdrop of these events, namely the incidents in which blacks are killed by police officers. And you give us some numbers. And, of course, the most raw numbers are of the roughly 1,000 people killed by cops in the United States each year. More than a quarter of them are black, even though blacks are not one quarter of our population. But so there is a disproportion there. But you say there's an even more serious disproportion when it comes to unarmed blacks being killed by police officers. Explain this distinction in the statistics that is important for us to understand.
Sure. So we know from studies that if you are a black person in America, you are more likely to be on the receiving end of force from our police officers. And I think that we don't have great scientific data about why. We have some pretty obvious theories. I would say that boil down to two in particular. One is that black residents, because of this country's history with how we've handled zoning and education and schools, are more likely to live in poorer, crime-ridden areas, and therefore cops are more likely to be on higher alert and to use force against black people. So I think that, you know, that's one of the ideas that the book attempts to sort of grapple with, not really in any detailed way, but just to get at why are these phenomena happening. And I think that the answer is we know that they are, but we don't have a ton of great data detailing exactly why.
So the events unfold that night, and they are incredibly dramatic and, of course, terrifying for all who were part of this. Are there lingering questions about exactly what unfolded that night and why? Or by and large, are there enough accounts and enough videos and so on that there is very little question about exactly what happened and when? I guess I'm asking the question because, for instance, if you were writing a book about an important battle in warfare, I mean, some significant battle during the Civil War or whatever, that in sort of the chaos of such a war, of such an event, it's impossible for the participants caught in the middle of it to necessarily see the whole of it. And sometimes we really don't know exactly everything we want to know. Is this an incident in which we really can know almost everything that happened moment by moment?
That's a really interesting question. I think that we know a lot about what happened. And I say that because there is a video of a tremendous amount of it. So you can hear the words people are saying, and you can see how things are unfolding on the timeline. And so I do think we know a great deal about what happened. That said, I do think that you make a good point. There's always stuff that's unknown. For instance, we don't know truly what was going on in the gunman's mind. We know what he said to the negotiator, but we don't know a tremendous amount about who he was and where he came from. We know a bit, but there's certainly more that that has not sort of gotten out there. So I think that's a good point. We know We know a lot, but do we know everything? No.
Well, it is extraordinary what unfolds. And I want to ask you about one other interesting observation that one of the participants makes at one point. And this is in the chapter, which is called The Firefight, which is basically when those officers first go into the building where the gunman is hiding and still armed and still incredibly dangerous. And at some point in the course of that description of those incredibly dramatic moments, one of the SWAT team members says this, that it is the thinking of most SWAT officers that when something happens that should not happen, it's often a matter of cops who have not been taught how to manage fear. I thought that was such an interesting idea and probably really crucial in our understanding of why sometimes these incidents occur. What do you feel like you learned as you covered this particular event and covering policing about the importance of helping all police officers learn how to better manage their fear?
I thought that was also a really fascinating concept here. And I think as you're talking about one of the SWAT officers who was involved in that firefight was a music major. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that's also your kind of your area.
Yes, yes, actually it is. Yes.
Yes. and he talks about how he would just spend hours and hours in practice rooms learning a Rachmaninoff piece and just, you know, spending years perfecting a single piece of music, and how shocking it was to go to the police academy and you're learning these life or death concepts, you know, in an hour. And so he has really made a study of how the body works while it's attempting to process fear. You know, we have all these biological mechanisms that start working, whether we are fully aware of them or not, with adrenaline. And I think some of the SWAT officers really see some of the shootings through the lens of, you know, we're sending officers out on the streets to confront some dangerous situations, and we aren't really training them enough probably in how to manage the reaction of fear in their own body, where they really start taking actions before they have really been able to assess what's actually happening. So one of the SWAT officers likes to say to people who are trying to make the team, he likes to say, you know, I don't care how good you shoot. I don't care how fast you run. I want to know if you can see. And just the ability to really be able to see information, process information. So I think some of the SWAT officers would like to see the conversation into training. How can we better equip officers to make better, smarter decisions under stress is really a concrete thing that could be done to improve policing. Mm.
And one hopes that some moves in that direction have already occurred and will continue to occur. I think as I read your book, I think one of the things I came away understanding better than I ever had before was the difficulty of police work. And not that that difficulty is in any way than a license for police officers to engage in unethical behavior or to discharge their challenging duties with anything but the highest integrity and attention to not only the word of law but just human decency. But at the same time, I think your book also helps us understand how there are those split-second moments when an officer, often under very difficult circumstances, is confronted with very, very difficult choices that need to be made in an instant. How much did you think about shaping that aspect of this book and making that point?
I think that's a good question. I think that One of the things, if you talk to police officers, one of the things they will tell you is that they feel unfairly judged by these second-long video clips, that they don't really give the public an understanding of the cumulative stress and difficulty of what they're actually doing every day. So I did want to try in some way to just reflect that, you know, when an officer ends up on a video, there's the whole career of moments that led him there in terms of thought and process and training. And so really to just try to expand that view a little bit and to maybe give us all a greater understanding of sort of what we're seeing when we see those moments, the beginnings and the middles of what's happened.
Our last question. Our studios are located actually in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which was the site of an incident caught on video involving a police officer and a shooting and demonstrations and riots that unfolded in the wake of it. And it, of course, has meant that this city needs to confront some very difficult questions, as other cities have all around the country. How would you have us move forward when it comes to some of these really difficult matters? What do you think the conversation, in a sense, needs to look like?
You know, it's funny. The first thing that comes to my mind is one of Shatamia Taylor's favorite lines that she likes to tell her children, which is, closed mouth, open mind gets you a long way in life. And I think the spirit of listening is really probably the most important thing we're in need of doing right now, just really listening and hearing where other people are coming from and making room for that, I think is really the best place to start.
The book is incredible, and it is dedicated for the ones who didn't make it home and the ones who did. It's titled Standoff: Race, Policing, and a Deadly Assault That Gripped a Nation, published by Henry Holt & Company, the author Jamie Thompson. Jamie Thompson, I thank you so much for writing this extraordinary book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Love talking to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am excited to share with you an interview I recorded with Barry Yagoda, who was a media advisor to Jimmy Carter during his presidential campaign and during the early years of his presidency. And Barry Yagoda has written a memoir about his experiences, which is titled Journeys with Jimmy Carter and Other Adventures in Media. And on Friday, a topic near and dear to my heart, choral music and choral singing, and the conundrum faced by choral directors across the country and indeed around the world of how to safely do choral music during this time of COVID-19, during this pandemic. We'll be talking about it at the collegiate level with Dr. James Kinchin, Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, who is Director of Choral Activities at Carthage College, sharing their thoughts and the success story that they each enjoyed at their respective colleges over the course of the past few months. It's exactly 9 o'clock. We remind you that The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org.